Which is why I didn't want to speak say that. I think to see the details of the sticks of mortgage before the breaks. You gave the same half your second page to say the highest percentage of all come back. So, simply our minds. The immediate position of my hands and hands. But you should offer insinuations that might be raised if it should exist. And that's the point that I have to raise. We may think initially that these might be intelligence differences, because this is a well-known gradient of intelligence across these three Asian groups. So I have a letter to the explanation. I think if you were directly to ask that, you would understand that in a month's time you're going to make a repayment on your mortgage. I think that would say, yes, you do understand that. I think it's a different kind of race difference. Green psychology, or the need for instant gratification as opposed to the capacity to delay gratification. Economists have the same concept, which they call time preferences. Some people are considered the same concept, there's quite a lot of evidence being negligent by psychologists that blacks have stronger needs for instant gratification. For instance, there are studies in which black children are given this choice. We say, would you like a bar of chocolate now? Or would you like two bars in a week's time? We find that black children tend to say, I'd like one now. The black children say, no, come on, I have two in a week's time. So I suspect that the difference lies in these time preferences between races.
Yes, I mean, from an economic point of view, business point of view, that wouldn't necessarily translate into different default rates if financial institutions were allowed to encourage to draw upon their empirical experience with different types of lenders. However, in the United States, for decades, that has been absolutely against the law. And so that, in fact, it's not just against the law to treat different, to not lend at equal rates to different groups, but even discussing reasons, discussing questions of whether you get paid back can expose your financial institution to a lot of danger and lawsuits. Typically, companies are sued routinely for discrimination, and plaintiff's attorneys ask in the discovery process for all the emails and memos. So if it turns out that somebody, some vice president somewhere, wrote down something and says, you know, we're making a whole lot of loans in a all Mexican district in San Bernardino for $400,000 up, where's the money going to come from to pay for this? Are we sure people aren't just going out and blowing it on quinceañera parties? Memo comes out, if an email like that gets discovered, it's going to be all over the newspapers. The guy who wrote it's going to get fired. His CEO is going to be have to go down to the National Council of La Raza and promise to lend even more money to minorities. So basically, it's all been just kind of pounded out of the consciousness of society. It's the kind of thing you can talk about with drinks, but these different default rates, different time preferences, and so forth are basically radioactive to think about in any kind of written fashion. And so people don't. And it winds up costing a huge amount of money. Thanks. Yes. Just wanted to mention, Steve, National Council of La Raza is a Latino pressure group. It translates as the national, it's just the National Council of the Race, which is a Mexican term for Mexicans, the race. Most people have our most tribes down through history have terms like we are the only human beings is the name of their group. So La Raza is a pressure group equivalent to, say, Jesse Jackson's for blacks.
If I understood you correctly, you first studied to show that the IQ of British black kids at Harvard University were consistently lower than the IQs of poor white kids at the University of America.
I didn't refer to IQ. The fact is that these academic achievement tests are very highly correlated with IQ. I did not say that the IQ of black students at Harvard is lower. I didn't mention that. The point is this. If you take, I can give you another example. There is a series of the National Assessment of Education Progress tests given by the U.S. government to a broad section of Americans, children, first grade, third grade, sixth grade, in all sorts of fields. The average black sixth grader can solve a science problem as well as the average black 12th grader can solve a science problem as well as the average white sixth grader. But the interesting point is if you just take the children of black and white college graduates, the difference between the races is greater than if you take all blacks and whites. But that is Galton's law of regression to the mean. It's a fundamental law of genetics discovered by Francis Galton, who was Charles Darwin's first cousin. And he did it with height. If you have individuals, he was actually doing it with plants, any plant or animal. If the parents are abnormal for their gene pool on a given genetic factor, their offspring regress about halfway to the mean of the gene pool. Galton never applied that to intelligence. It was another man who made the Stanford Binet intelligence test, I can't remember his name, in California, who noticed that the children of poor, uneducated Jews and Orientals did better on the intelligence test than the children of wealthy, educated white Gentiles. He realized this was a regression to the mean of the gene pool. Only later was it seen that also applied to blacks and whites, that there's a very strong regression to the mean of that gene pool. Now, for instance, I'll give you another instance. At any given IQ of the parents, black children are 13 times more likely to be mentally retarded in the United States. In other words, the children of black parents with a 120 IQ have much less of a chance of being mentally retarded than the children of black parents with an 80 IQ. But the children of black parents with 120 IQ are 13 times more likely to be mentally retarded than the children of white parents with a 120 IQ.
If I might say something about affirmative action at Harvard, there's been a controversy in recent years led by Henry Louis Gates, the head of the African-American Studies Department, and Lonnie Muir, Harvard Law School. They've been pointing out, it hasn't been very popular, what they've been saying, but they've been pointing out that Harvard's African-American students are largely not really African-Americans. They're a lot more like Barack Obama than they are like Michelle Obama. They tend to be the African-American students who get into Harvard tend to have either a white parent or grandparent or are immigrant stock from the Caribbean or Africa, Barack Obama being a classic example. Michelle Obama is genuine African American descendant from slaves on all four grandparents' sides. And when people think about affirmative action, they often think about it as compensation for slavery. But like in the case of Harvard, they're just basically, they aren't coming up with enough Harvard quality students, so they're reaching out and taking in all sorts of foreign students and people like Barack Obama who were raised in Wayne, Ireland. So Whittier and Gates have been pointing this out, and we don't want to think about it.
That's part Professor Hoppe insisted my talk be 30 minutes, and for 3 weeks I went over it at least an hour a day, crossing out sentences and paragraphs and single words to get it down there. But that would have been part of it when I said I showed this in my book, the vast majority of blacks who receive benefit from affirmative action in the United States are immigrants or the descendants of immigrants who came after 1965. And that survey, there was a survey conducted among Harvard undergraduates by a black student. The Harvard administration tried to stop the survey. She came from the United States, and she was completely black. And she said when she told her, black fellow students asked her where she came from, and she said the United States, they'd reply incredulously, "No, where do you really come from?"
A question to Professor Dockrin about the AMS. Professor Dockrin, as far as I understand, if you do not consider that this market might be state predecessor of the modern European state, constitutional monopoly, egalitarian model intended to control and pacify the underclass, are taking into account the preventers work of the underclass, they do indeed see constitute a political problem. Given the capacity of growing one organization themselves,
control over the situation. For one thing, I would vastly limit the number of immigrants that come into these European countries for many reasons, one of which is that it's very difficult to assimilate them, increasingly difficult to assimilate them to a national culture. Another reason is that these nations are in a state of dissolution, self-rejection in the case of the Germans in particular. And therefore, there's nothing really to assimilate them into, other than hating themselves as Germans, and if they're Turks, I suppose you really did. In fact, there was actually a very interesting article which I read in a German newspaper, which is actually the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung. It was something about the Turks who come into Germany do not want to accept guilt for the Holocaust. And they say, that's what some Germans accept guilt for the Holocaust. Well, I mean, people who reach that state of self-degradation should be trying to assimilate other people. They should all visit shrinks to deal with their own problems without trying to absorb other populations. So I think the amount of immigration is unrealistic if one wishes to preserve any kind of national identity in these countries. And by national identity, I mean something other than teaching them democratic universal rights. I mean, we have to teach them something that is culturally specific, which relates to those people. There's always the story told about Cindy Gaudet, who had to study that about the mise en scène de l'Ivoire they would actually learn, but they were taught to think of themselves as Frenchmen. Well, obviously, people are coming don't think of themselves, you know, as admirers of the Habsburgs or Kaiser Wilhelm or Bismarck. They really have no identification with these countries where they're coming to live. And there are parallel societies which the political class is setting up. So I think as a first measure to deal with these terminally ill nations, or perhaps terminally ill nations, I would try to remove the immigration problem as much as I could. I also would cut the immigration, I would not give any kind of special treatment to those immigrants who are there. And if they commit crimes, they should be deported at once, even if they're not sans papiers, even if they're illegally there, they should be removed from the country. But I think it's also important simply to end the kind of immigration flood that's been coming into Europe, and it's very, very seriously. And for these nations to sort of take stock of themselves and to try to understand the requirements to be nations. And the part of it is an escape through immigration into from what they are historically. And there's a desire to lose their identity in something else, a kind of multicultural world. I think they really have to come to grips with this emotional, the sheer emotional problem. And immigration is not going to be the immigration is going to add to crime. It's going to add to social problems. The only ones who are going to benefit are the social workers and the governing class, which is involved in re-socializing the indigenous population.
Yes, I'm not altogether keen on the notion of an underclass, at least in Britain, because the problem is much wider than that of an underclass. I was, for a time, the vulgarity correspondent of the British newspaper, which was not itself completely immune from vulgarity, but they used to send me wherever the British were gathering and behaving badly, which, of course, was more or less wherever they were gathering. And on one occasion, they sent me to a so-called friendly football match between Italy and England. And, of course, Rome hadn't seen anything like it since 410 AD. And there are about 10,000 people in the English crowd, and they were all, of course, shouting obscenities for hours on end and making what were very similar to fascist salutes. And I think I was the only one out of 10,000 who wasn't. And at half time, it had all calmed down a little. And I spoke to the chap next to me. I said, excuse me, if you don't mind me asking this, why have you come all this way to shout obscenities at the Italians for hours? And he said, well, I have to let my hair down. The point about these people who were behaving so badly was that they were all middle class and that they had very good jobs. In fact, they were auctioneers from Sotheby's, perhaps that doesn't surprise you. The revelation about Sotheby's. But they all had very good jobs. So there is, at least in Britain, an idea or a reversal, a gestalt switch of what is considered good and bad. So that we now, I don't know whether you know the lines from Paradise Lost, but when Satan is expelled from heaven, he says, evil, be thou my good. And that is what has happened in to a large extent in Britain. So the problem is not one of immigrants, in my view. The fact that we have abandoned our own attractive characters makes us it makes it impossible for us to absorb immigrants. And when I look at the behaviour of people in Britain, and I try to look at it with the eyes of an immigrant, I can't see why they would wish to integrate themselves into this mess.
that's one question. All of them by then, something how you think that the American Empire is going. Would it be the global collapse of the Soviet ship? Would it be the election of war to come from Russia? Or do you have any other feeling about how the American Empire went?
Well, I'm not a fortune teller, but I'm not a fortune teller, so I can't presume to know the future in any regard, including this one, but I have what you might call educated speculations. I'm quite sure that it will not end because Ron Paul is elected president. So if you want to bank on that, feel confident. But I think economic difficulties will increasingly constrain the maintenance of the American empire and are already beginning to do so. For the moment, the U.S. government is acting as if there are no constraints and everything can be dealt with simply by creating more money. But that solution will soon be revealed as bankrupt, literally, because it's self-defeating. And when it is seen to be self-defeating, there won't, in my view, be any good alternatives to it other than constriction of the scope of the American empire. So I can foresee some base closures, some reductions in military spending, some other changes that will diminish the size and reach of American military forces on a worldwide scale. How far that will go depends on how bad the financial collapse or other forms of financial difficulty turn out to be. And there we get into so many uncertainties that I'm not willing to make many educated guesses other than that I believe within the next 1 to 3 years, accelerating inflation will probably reach levels that cause the American authorities to impose price controls. And once price controls are imposed, then so many difficulties ensue because of those controls that it's hard to say what happens. Of course, they're harmful to economic productivity, so they limit real output, they increase poverty, and so ultimately, people may realize, as they always have in the past when Americans have imposed price controls, that it would be good to give up the controls and restore a more normal type of economy. I think that's going to be more difficult to do on this occasion. I don't think, however, the probability of doing it is zero. We had a very great increase of money stock during World War II, combined with wage and price controls and many other forms of economic control. So, in fact, during World War II, the United States had a command in time. What looked like two markets were so constrained and rigged and controlled indirectly, if not directly, that the whole economy can actually be considered a command in time. But that was terminated after the war ended, for the most part. Free price system was allowed to operate once again, and an adjustment was made to the fact that the money stock had nearly doubled during the war. So what will happen in the future now may resemble what happened then. If it does, we'll be the luckiest people on earth. I don't think it will go so well this time for a variety of reasons, if you take the far field and you take your conjecture and guesswork to say any more.
I have a question for you, Mr. Lee, also there. Before I ask this question, I make it clear I confess that I'm not being paid by the American Department. When the Russian troops were stopped in April, 1945, they were sort of east of Hanover.
this will still be flat, but he has a claim to have a fall with him. He's flying up the River Rhine, then it's on the Rhine, and my cousin is sleeping with him, and on the road, on the English side, he's doing the left side of the line, he's beautiful, safe, and he to come to my question, do you have any idea how much money could be saved out of all these big camps without finding different styles of the world today? How much less money could have been spent?
Well, that's a very large question, and you know, the best answer I can give to it would be a kind of rough and ready guess. I'm fairly sure that we could have got equally good results at half the expense. I think until you actually delve into the inner workings of the military-industrial congressional complex, you really cannot appreciate the degree of sheer waste, absurdity, idiocy that goes on and that continues year after year. Studies that have been made since the 1950s by so-called Blue Ribbon Commissions to study the Department of Defense and its contracting operations in particular with private suppliers. Each one of these major studies reaches almost identical conclusions because nothing ever changes fundamentally. By the 1950s, the people who benefit most from the operation of this apparatus had entrenched it so deeply that nothing can be done by critics to change it or to diminish it. I think the only real hope of diminishing the amount of sheer waste in the defense apparatus is if the entire government budget shrinks so that the military portion has to shrink along with it. It can be starved, but otherwise I think it is the closest thing we have in this world to a perpetual theft machine. My old friend, Ernie Fitzgerald, who was an efficiency engineer for the Air Force for more than 50 years and became famous when President Nixon said on one of the tapes, "Fire that son of a bitch." And after 10 years in the courts, got his job back with some compensation. Ernie used to say, a defense contract is a license to steal. I think that's a pretty good definition of what it is or how it works.
Yeah, my question is, currently the U.S. spends about half of all military spending in the world, and everyone else in the world's military spending as a percentage of their GDP, just about everybody else, has been headed down. It's really quite low. The U.S. is stuck at about 4% of GDP. I guess the really big question is everybody else backing off on military spending because the U.S. is so dominant, or is it just because basically they don't see war as pain anymore? War used to be very profitable when you grab some territory, you got the farmers and minerals, but now it's mostly buildings and war kills people and breaks things, and is there any way to make money out of it? So I guess the big question, I don't have an answer to it, is the U.S. cut back on military spending, will other countries go, this is our chance, or you just say, well, don't you sell a lot? War just doesn't pay.
I want to make a comment in response to what you said about, it was good that the Americans were there when the Russians were coming in from the east. And I think this is sort of focused the issue on the timeliness of American presence in wars, and how good it was that the Americans pulled the chestnuts of the French out of the fire in World War I or something like this. One could also, of course, point to the fact that American involvement was very often caused harm in complicated military situations that might have been resolved differently, such as World War I, which might actually have been ended with a negotiated peace between the two sides once they had finished fighting each other. The problem is that at least since the early 20th century, there has been a well-organized group that has controlled American foreign policy, or at least has sold a certain foreign policy to the country. Our major foreign policy magazines, such as Foreign Affairs, are controlled by this group. And it's the Council on Foreign Relations, which has existed since 1919, when Elihu Root, the Progressive Republican, together with various Democrats, came together and founded it for the purpose of involving the United States in the affairs of Europe. And we're always told it's a terrible thing the United States did not join the League of Nations. I think it's a very good thing that they did not join the League of Nations, because it would have been perpetually committed to keeping down the Germans in the 1920s when on the side of the English and the French. And I think we should maintain the kind of neutrality once the war was over. We probably should not have been involved in the war in the first place. But the continuing involvement in the United States in European affairs, the use of American armies to spread the democratic values of the United States, all these things have been pushed by the Council on Foreign Relations. And the only regret of the Council on Foreign Relations is that most Americans do not think constantly about foreign involvement. And needless to say, there is a military-industrial complex that is very supportive of the Council on Foreign Relations. And there are, in fact, interlocking groups that are responsible for American what's very often called bilateralism in our foreign policy is the fact that the Republicans and Democrats are both equally involved in the business of exporting American democracy, committing American troops abroad, and so forth. So that even if one can find occasionally good or benevolent uses of the American military, it has in fact been a kind of perpetual machine involving, and it has been connected to bankers, such as the Rockefeller family, which is supported the Council on Foreign Relations, which supported their foreign policy, the Morgan family in World War I. So what you have are interlocking economic, ideological interests that have been behind the creation of this vast American empire that Bob has been describing.
Question for the center. Thank you for your information on some of the major causes of the economic crisis. My question is the following. Do you think next time that there could be or there was any level of understanding that the monetary policy of the Fed is stronger than the regulation in the US that caused such a terrible outcome, and there was an attempt to prevent it or to leave?
Thank you. So the question is, would something else have gone terribly wrong if it weren't for this? Is that a good question?
Yeah, well, my question is whether what you said was known in advance. So back in 1997 or year 2000, there was anybody in the bank sector or in the government or whatever, said we go on this way, and how many times we can help them?
No, I don't think it just never came on. The confession of my own, I can vividly recall looking at a newspaper in about the year 2002, reading a little article that said that that Fannie Mae, a government-sponsored enterprise that buys all bundles of mortgages, had just committed to $440 million to President Bush's program for increasing minority home ownership. And I looked at that and I thought, you know, $440 billion here, $440 billion there, pretty soon you're talking about real money. And then I put the newspaper aside and basically didn't think about it again for several years. And I would suspect I'm more cynical than most people. So basically, this seemed like a really good idea to everybody who was anyone in America, Democrats and Republicans. One of the funny things is, for example, that I have not found a single partisan Democrat who has attacked George Bush's, has mentioned George Bush's White House conference on increasing minority home ownership. They've attacked him for everything else, but this whole series of steps leading up to that conference where he leaned on everybody to cut down payment requirements and told and sent a message to federal regulators, you know, to basically not take the punch bowl away from the party when things get interesting. Not a single liberal in the United States has even mentioned that event. You can Google all of them, but it hasn't come up because it's much more important within the United States for Democrats to denounce Republicans as racist than it is for them to put together a coherent story of how Republicans ran the economy. So basically, everybody bought, who said anything in public, said, well, this was a fine idea. And so nobody saw it coming because we basically have our reality helped fields up to basically not pay attention to these things involving race. So we're paying the price.
Actually, I'd like to, I mean, after this, I'd like to question someone. Go ahead, Jensen.
Yes, question for Steve Singer. You are conclusively realized that Obama inherited from his father the dream of being a great political leader and to do good for the black race. I think I'll explain why that Obama's father was also a Marxist. So then the question is, to what extent did Barack Obama also inherit dream of Marxism? Is he deciding his conviction of Marxism?
Yeah, it's a good question. To review a little bit, Barack Obama Sr. met Anne Dunham when she was 17, co-ed, and they got married a couple months later, they gave him away. And then Barack Sr. was graduated from the University of Hawaii in 3 years. He was there on a Cold War scholarship program to bring young elites from Kenya to the United States as part of the Cold War struggle for the hearts and minds of Kenyans. After he graduated in just 3 years, and so the usual four, he topped his class and got a scholarship to Harvard. At that point, he also has a scholarship offered at another college in New York that was waiting for his wife and son to come along. But Harvard was Harvard, so he went to Harvard and left his wife and son behind, married an American woman when he was there. I guess that would be his third wife, by the way, he still had a wife in Kenya. The bigamous aspect is really just kind of downplayed. All right. At that point, so basically, Barack only, Jr. only saw Barack Sr. for 1 month after that. However, he heard about his father all the time from his mother because she then fell in love with another third world student at the University of Hawaii, an Indonesian fellow in the world. And he was another leftist, you know, talked of revolution and so forth. And they got married, and then after about a year, and then he had to go into the Indonesian army. And then she moved, then Dunham Obama Soetaro by this point moved to Indonesia. But when she got there, she discovered she was no longer in love with her second husband. And in fact, she started finding it real annoying because he just wasn't the romantic revolutionary he'd been as a student in Hawaii. He was now working for an American oil company, diligently rising up the corporate ladder. And he was always asking her to come to dinners with his American contacts because they'll expect you there. You were their people. And she would get very mad at him and say, "They are not my people." So she, her her second husband was proving to be a very good stepfather to young Barak Jr. He was really teaching him how to be, you know, how to get high and really helping him out with all sorts of things. And she increasingly resented her second husband's influence over her son. And to counter that, as Barak Jr. describes in some detail, the only authority figure she could come up with was his biological father, who was held back in Kenya, and occasionally would write letters, but mostly she sort of created a myth about him. The reason he couldn't be with his beloved son was because he had to go back to his country to fight for his people, to write, to become a political leader, to do the proper thing, to work, to lead his people to greatness, unlike his stepfather, who was merely supporting his wife and stepson. And so she sort of basically inculcated an ideology, black racialist ideology, in her son as part of her kind of passive-aggressive war on her Indonesian second husband. It took, Obama believed it all. It was quite shocking to him when he was in his later 20s, around age 26, when he finally discovered from his half-siblings in Kenya that his father's had failed terribly in life due to alcoholism, drunken car crashes, and so forth. We do know a lot about what his father had felt up through about the year 1965. This is presumably what his father had told his mother, and his mother then passed on this ideology to her son. And that is that Barak Sr. wrote a paper in 1965 kind of criticizing Tom Mboya's African socialism, which was kind of a more moderate, politically centrist point of view, generally to the light of most of African thinking at the time. The key point was for Barak Sr. was that Tom Mboya and his boss, Jomo Kenyatta, did not intend to take away the property of whites and Asian businesses in Kenya. And Barak Sr. took what we might now call a Mugabean's line about that since whites and Asians dominated the Kenyan economy, they basically had to be expropriated. So I'm not sure if I would call it really Marxist. I don't see much in this article that was published by Barak Sr. in 1965. It's distinctly Marxist. It's more kind of, you know, socialist, yes, but it's more kind of internationalist. It's more racial socialism than socialism for its own sake. Comparison to Robert Mugabe stands out. So, sorry about taking a long time, but that is kind of the intellectual background that he was raised in. And so when he talks about his deepest commitments, that is something that would be interesting to ask him. It explains a lot about why he spent 20 years in Reverend Jeremiah Wright's church, why he gave over $50,000 to Reverend Wright since his election to the United States Senate. Seems like a fairly simple and straightforward explanation. He sought out Jeremiah Wright because he agreed with him.
Now, I have a question, Rick, Mr. Hicks here. After it spoke, I came up and I asked him about the Korean War. Did he think that was justified? He said no. He did have to agree that the people of South Korea were incomparably better off because the United States did prevent the North Korean invasion. But what about this point that has been made? If in 1945, after the Second World War was over, the United States would have withdrawn its troops completely from the United States, mostly disarmed, grabbed enough of a force it thought could defend the United States itself from attack, make it clear that that's all the United States is going to do. It's nearly certain that the Soviet Union would have imposed communist regimes throughout continental Europe. Decades of tyranny, murder, torture, starvation Don't you think the United States had to keep a strong military presence to prevent that?
Yes,
I'm asking.
I don't know what was necessary at that point. It's certainly the case that with the United States there to bulk up the Western Europeans, it was easier to fend off the Soviets at that point. I'm not sure what the point of the question is.
Well, should the United States have done what you seem to be advocating? As a general principle, with no exceptions, the United States just an army to defend its own borders. Or have I gotten you wrong? Because in order to defend, where the Soviet Union had the most powerful and the largest manned army in the world at that time, in order to have a credible defense of Western Europe, the United States had to keep up a good size on
it. May I jump into this?
Yes.
Because I think it's an interesting question. No, I do not think the United States should pull that view of 1945. I also do not believe the United States should enter World War I, should have been co-responsible for the Treaty of Versailles. I do not think we should have firebombed all those cities in 1942 and 1945. It should not have yielded as often as it did, nor should the British have yielded as often as they did to Stalin. They probably could have ended the Second World War by negotiating with the non-Nazi government in Germany, which existed, but which Churchill helped to undermine. After all those mistakes were made by the United States, though I think it should have stayed in Europe in 1945, and keep the rest of the continent being swallowed up by Stalin. Yes, I do. On the other hand, I don't think we should forget all the mistakes that were made before that brought about that situation in 1945. I don't think European history did not start in 1945, nor did it start in 1938. And I think America is responsible, or co-responsible, for many of the mistakes that were made throughout the history of the early 20th century.
Well, I would say a little more in response to the question. It's a little difficult for me at this stage of my thinking to wrap my mind around that kind of question. People talk in those terms all the time. Should the United States do this? Should Britain do that? And so forth. This, to my mind, is a way of thinking about my being advisor to the prince. And in my mind, all these princes are kings, all of them. And so questions like this put me in the position of saying, should criminal number 3 have done such and such vis-a-vis criminal number 17? Well, that's a difficult question to answer. I tend to think more in terms of questions of right and wrong conduct by individuals. Think in terms of individuals protecting themselves from criminals, who, particularly those who form and operate nation states. I think in terms of free people, individuals, all of whom are beset by criminals on all sides. Usually, the most menacing criminal of all is the government that purports to be their own ruler. All of these criminals can do this good that they do, such as fending off the Red Army and keeping it out of France and Holland. They can do it only by committing a multitude of crimes of their own, and not otherwise. They cannot operate in any other fashion. These nation states cannot get resources except by threatening to kill people who will not cough up resources to them, which in my mind is extortion at best. So I don't give advice to the prince. Neither Prince Number 3 nor Prince Number 17.
Well, I have a question going back to immigration and multiculturalism, which was discussed at the beginning of this session. And it's a question. A general question to the panel. I've been an immigrant since I was the age of 25 in 3 different countries, and I'm now an immigrant in the UK. And I wonder whether, A, I have a right to be where I am,
okay? I am not in my country. And if I have this right, why not other people? I mean, where does one draw the line? It is true that I support myself in fears I had in the other countries where I did, like inform benefits or things like that, which would not be the same for developing people and okay. But if I want, for instance, to have a Filipino maid or a Syrianese private or an accountant from India, and maybe 10 accountants for India, such as the state of my finances, and I was, why should I be prevented, and on what ground would other people prevent me from importing this stuff? That is the question. And I think that to answer other issues that have been discussed about multiculturalism, isn't it a misnomer? Is it the problem of most immigrants that they simply do not have a culture? So there isn't a multiculturalism. There are people who may or may not have a culture in a certain country, and other people who come in who are completely structured without any sort of culture to speak of. My problem is when I am with people of different races, different cultures, different origins, and so on, is whether they are honest, whether they are going to bug me in the street. It's a problem of criminality, and this applies to any nationality or any ethnic group and so on. And look, I think somebody has mentioned on the panel that it is going to change the culture of the United States, it's going to change the culture of England and so on. So many things change the culture of a country. Think of cinema in the 1920s, television in the 1950s, or the internet in the 1990s. I mean, a lot of things are changing culture. So if there are groups of people who come and have a strong culture, not folklore, but a strong culture, living in a neighborhood, living in another town, or living in the same town, the same building, I mean, is it really a problem if they are honest and so on?
Well, let me jump in here. The argument for open borders can be an appealing one, in theory.
Sorry, can I just stop you here?
Yes, please.
I didn't say open borders. I said if I import people because I want to work with them from India and so on, that is not an argument for open borders. It is the same argument as open trade. In other words, if I buy a foreign car comes to this country, it is because I bought it or somebody else bought it. It's not because it landed on my doorstep.
Yeah, there's a couple of points. One is the issue of privatizing profits while socializing costs. As a Californian, very sensitive to this, a lot of studies have been done. For example, California has long imported huge number of migrant farm workers, skilled labor. The farms in California are much less mechanized than the ones in Australia, for example, because they have a very cheap supply of labor from south of the border. However, it's not clear that the farmer, the large landowners, account for all the costs of education, of health care, policing, imprisonment, and so forth and so on. California right now, if you're looking at newspapers, is basically broke, trying to get more handouts from the federal government. On the supply side, the number of people who could want to move to the United States is quite large. A fascinating statistic that I stumbled upon is that the number of people in the world who live in countries with a lower per capita GDP than Mexico is about 5,043,000,000. So there is an almost unlimited supply of potential economic immigrants to the United States who it would take a long time before the standard of living in the United States would plummet down to the level of Bangladesh. So the question is, what we've been seeing is that large-scale immigration in California can lead of typically of people with little education, who may have good work habits, but not much education to bring to it, has turned out to be extremely expensive, as we've seen with mortgage lending, with the gigantic deficits run by the state of California. It's really been an experiment in what happens. Then you have political changes. California voted for the Republican candidate for president every year from 1952 to 1988, with the exception of 1964, 9 out of 10 times. It's gone Democratic in the last 5 elections. That has a lot to do with immigration. New immigrants tend to vote for tax and spend candidates on very rational grounds. It also has an impact on the natives. People in California may recently make their living with, say, government civil service jobs, combining work as teachers, nurses, prison guards, and so forth. I would suggest that one thing about America's immigration system is it tends to be very emotionally driven, with all sorts of appeals to the Statue of Liberty and so forth. Civilized countries like Canada and Australia have a more rational system where they make you apply and prove your usefulness to the current citizens of Canada or Australia. About 8 years ago, I went online and I took the test to see if I was worthy of immigrating to Canada, and I failed. And I must say that, I was rather impressed, Groucho Marx said he didn't want to belong to the club that we would have him. Sort of kind of made me feel like I wanted to move to Canada. But those are different kinds of systems. And they do take into account some of these costs by trying, Canada has basically been trying to skim the cream off the human capital from around the world. Now, that has a lot of problems. But you don't see Canada going broke in California. Currently is.
Can I also answer this? In the United States, you have the peculiar problem that all non-European immigrants, no matter how rich or educated they are eligible for affirmative action along with their descendants, seemingly for all time. But it isn't only the United States. France, the French government kept telling the French people, we need these Arab and Black immigrants to do work that French people are no longer willing to do. Now, something like 35% of Arab and Black men between the ages of 18 and 40 in France are unemployed. And the government is desperately trying to make employment for the people who are supposed to be there doing work that French people didn't want to do. And for years, France has now had affirmative action for Blacks and Arabs so they can do jobs that French people do want to do, and take them for French people who are much more qualified to do them.
Yeah, I wanted to add something too about the notion that cultures continue to change. I think we probably would disagree here on the nature of community, because I do believe there are national communities which are continuing communities, although they're not entirely fixed. But I think that what is happening now is that the government is imposing multiculturalism. It is not that the culture is simply changing. The government is reshaping the culture and using immigrants at least partly to do this. And you see this in the United States with the attempt to sort of push Hispanic culture, government support for a group with a racist name like La Raza. And that was something that David Ferrer mentioned, the way minorities coming in. Excuse me?
Stephen
mentioned the way that minorities coming in from other parts of the world are immediately eligible for affirmative action. And the effect of these government actions is not to simply allow the culture to evolve, it is to force the culture in a politically correct direction.
I think we should take a break. in 15 minutes to real matter. What do you usually call it? Purpose.